This is continuing with David Dewhurst on 18th August 76.
So what became apparent later about the second background?
I was making some remark that it became apparent later that both sides were right and both sides were wrong, and some of the sources were right, some were wrong.
Right.
At the time it wasn't really clear, and as you know it, there was a certain amount of acrimony between the two groups.
But the optical astronomers such as you could talk to both groups. Minkowski is another example of that.
This was certainly true, and Minkowski and Bader were exactly in the same situation too, certainly.
Right.
The optical astronomers were in a completely neutral position in this.
So what did you find? Now, did you literally look at virtually every 3C position on the sky survey and?
For some areas of sky plates were not available. No, I did not look at the whole lot. I looked at maybe 50-60% of the more intense sources where it looked as if one was going to find something, and it did of course become a little bit discouraging. I still looked at some hundreds of areas of sky. And it did frankly become very discouraging. I looked at area of sky after area of sky, and with this nagging suspicion all the time that there was something staring one in the face, if you could only see what it was.
Did you blow up the areas and put them all next to each other to see if you could see any patterns or anything?
No, this was just looking at areas of sky and making careful notes. The principle where it was that maybe these were stars, or that some of them were stars. Mm-hmm. There was some peculiar kind of true radio star. They were obviously not the brightest star. I mean, if a succession of 3C positions had fallen on sort of Sirius and Arcturus and so on, I mean, one would have had no doubts about this.
Right.
But one would find in an error area that one looked at that there was a star on 9th, 10th, 11th magnitude, and you had the feeling, should I really go and look at all these stars, or look them up in the Henry Draper catalogue and find out what spectral type they are? And this sort of thing I did, and it's a very time-consuming operation to do. And again, as far as one could see, a disappointing and no result.
Mm. So if you looked at half the 3C sources, that would be roughly 200, 250 or so.
Yeah.
And roughly how many identifications did you come up with? How many new ones? At the Paris Symposium, I have from the abstract once again that you had 8 new possible or probable IDs.
Mm.
But I don't know if that was the entire.
No, I think there were many more. I had made notes of the existence of galaxies, bright galaxies, elliptical galaxies in certain positions. At the time, it just did not seem a sensible thing to do to publish an enormous list saying in the top right-hand corner of this error rectangle there is 13th, 15th, 17th magnitude galaxy which may or may not be associated. You have to remember, of course, that the work was still in progress on the 3C positions. I mean, that was not then a published catalogue. There was still work in progress, and some of the positions were slightly altered and refined, and when we went back and had a look. But when the 3C catalogue was published, we did make a note that there was a possible object in this area that I had looked at, so that this could be gone back and looked at again. And many of these did in the end turn out to be right.
Right.
For the brighter elliptical galaxies.
But you couldn't say at that time
At that time, certainly at the time of the Paris meeting, one couldn't say any more than what I did say there. Report in the Paris
So you felt that the Paris Symposium and plus these notes in the 3C catalogue was enough publishing, although that's an awful lot of work for the amount of
it was in a way.
Right. And one didn't know.
After that, for me, I think, and for us in Cambridge, this became a little bit disappointing and frustrating. I mean, we had the positions here, but we did not, of course, have easy access to a large telescope in this country. And at that time, it was not quite as easy as it was now to just trot off around the world and get observing time on large telescopes. There were not many large telescopes. And so without, you know, without any feeling of ill will at all, in fact, I continue, well, acting as an intermediary. I'm talking with radio astronomers here and looking at positions and for my meeting Minkowski or writing to Minkowski. But it was quite obvious that this was going to be done in Pasadena, where there were large telescopes, and it was here. And so this became a bit disappointing. And this, it wasn't with any sort of feeling of ill will or lack of interest and so on, but I did drop out of this a little bit at this time, partly because I got involved in other work that was going on here that I had to take my share in.
Let me ask you, if one took a look at the list of identified sources in 1958, 59, 60, that error, could you make any generalities? Well, you've already made a couple that they were...
I think one knew then that there were galaxies and extragalactic objects. Until, of course, there was the first quasar identification. And remember, that first quasar identification was not with a quasi-stellar object, but it was with a 12th magnitude star. I mean, there was a brief period when it was known that there were radio stars. It was only later that it became apparent.
You mean by mistake? What you're saying is that people were thinking that this is a radio star.
This was a true star in the galaxy.
Yes, and they're trying to figure out what the spectrum
was. It was only later.
Yes, right. It took a couple of years, I think, or a year at least.
And, of course, this... I remember my reaction to this was, well, you know, maybe I did overlook. Maybe some of these things were stars.
Right.
They were staring me in the face all the time, and I didn't recognize it. But, of course, you will always find stars of...
Sure.
Star-like objects, star-appearing objects on Schmidt photographs in... 60 square minutes of arc. I mean, there will be stars, lots of stars, and unless there's something very obvious about them, like an extreme color, extremely blue or extremely red, one will not recognize this on a Bernard Schmidt plate.
Right. At this time, did you have hope that indeed the positions would continue to improve, and it would be quite clear that the identifications would
come along? Yes. And this was really gratifying, as this happened, that as the radio positions were improved, it became obvious that particular objects that one had noted in these areas did in fact turn out to be the sources. And this was really gratifying.
Well, I think that covers pretty much what I was thinking of. Any other comments that you'd like to make about this whole...
I don't think so, apart from the obvious, enormous enjoyment and excitement of being involved in this. I felt at the time that this was really exciting, and I thought it's going to be important.
I think it's turned out that way.
I told you so. Yes. It has turned out that way. I could obviously get down to reminiscing about, you know, sort of personalities and what people I met and what they said about one another.
This is strictly in confidence. If I should want to quote anything, I will definitely be asking your permission. But
yes,
if it's relevant at all to the flavor of the times, I would appreciate it. Any comments you could make?
There was this very strong criticism. I mean, Cambridge radio astronomers. You know, I've been discussing some radio source or position, and I'd say, well, you know, sort of the way Sydney people say that maybe it's a little bit off that way. And there was, you know, pretty much the reaction, oh, you don't think that those positions aren't in that, and it must be in that lobe, you see, it must be in one of those three lobes. And if we say there's something there, it must be there, and, you know, Sydney people wouldn't find it. Then later on in Sydney, I'd have a similar sort of discussion with the Sydney radio astronomers and say, well, you can see the record there. I mean, that's real enough. And if the Cambridge people can't find it, well that's what you'd expect of
doing
it that way, you see. And it was rather silly in retrospect. But there was very much this atmosphere.
Right. But it also must have been rather discouraging for you. I mean, because you don't know who to believe, not being a radio engineer and this astronomer yourself.
Well, you see, the radio astronomers themselves, they didn't really, I mean, they placed confidence in their own results. It became evident later that there were difficulties in the one technique that the Cambridge people hadn't thought of, and there were difficulties in the Sydney technique that the Sydney people hadn't thought of. And all was eventually happily resolved, and everybody lived happily ever after. And radio astronomers actually come to conferences.
Right, here they are here this week. Yeah. Do you think it ever got in the way of the progress of the science?
Only for a very short time. Clearly it must have done, but only for a very short time. And I think the other thing that you have to remember, there was also a certain amount of rivalry and not all that much communication in I'm again talking of the very early days now, between the two radio astronomy groups in this country, between Cambridge and Manchester.
Sure, sure.
And this was very understandable because they were both competing for quite large sums of money from the same very small government pocket at that time, and it was natural that there shouldn't. Both groups felt that they were working along the right lines, although the lines were different, and there was naturally a certain amount of jealousy that they were anxious for the repute of their own group, and they wanted to be sure that they got the money.
Mm.
I don't think. Now, this could really offend anyone, and I can't remember whether I said this when I was recording for David Edge or not, that I was talking with, I suppose, Martin Ryle and Graham Smith, or one or two of the radio astronomers, and I made the remark that the Manchester people had invited me up to give a talk on colloquium or visit Jobby Bank, next week or the week or whatever time. And this was noted with interest, and one of my radio astronomy colleagues said, oh, well, someone told us that they were building a new aerial in the field, and we could find out.
Exactly. What did we
find out what this was for, yeah. You see. And I made a sort of mental note on the back of my cuff.
Right.
You see. And I would then get to Jolly Bank and either give a colloquium or talk to some of the people there. And they would then extend the normal courtesy of inviting me out to dinner before I caught the train back to Cambridge or whatever. And over dinner, it was obvious that they had thought of a number of questions that they would like to ask about what was going on in Cambridge.
Right.
It lasted for only a very short time, but it was a rather amusing.
Right.
It was rather amusing.
Once again, you were an intermediary.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
The interview with David Dewhurst on 18th August 1976.